Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam Boileau is on break this week, but we have two excellent fill-in co-hosts for you all. We did this last January, and it was so great we've decided to do it again. Gigamon's Joe Slowick and Red Canary's Katie Nichols will join me in just a moment to talk through all the week's security news. And then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, Okta. Mark Rogers is the Executive Director of Cybersecurity there, and he is joining us this week to talk about Log4j and some adjacent issues. He's working on a paper with IST about the bug and what it all means. And yeah, he's joining us this week to talk about why the Log4j drama was different to your regular run-of-the-mill bug and subsequent response. That is coming up later, but first up, of course, it is time for this week's news discussion with my special co-hosts, Joe Slowick and Katie Nichols. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us. Happy to be here again.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, so we got some good stuff to talk about this week. And first up, let's talk about a late-breaking item. CISA, the FBI, and the NSA put out a big sort of advisory and, you know, a whole bunch of information on Russian state-sponsored attacks targeting U.S. critical infrastructure. Katie, you were the first one to sort of paste this one into me in Slack as something we should talk about. We do see this sort of stuff coming from those agencies these days. Is this one particularly noteworthy?
Whenever one of these comes out, the first thing that I always ask is this strategic messaging by the U.S. government? And or is this related to recent attacks that anyone has actually observed? And I ask that question because a lot of security people are going to be asking us, those of us who track threats, what's happening? Why did the U.S. government release this?
Yeah, why
and
now,
so my
right?
Best, yeah, why now? So my best take on this, and I kind of ask others, and other people seem to agree with me here, is that this is related to sort of anticipatory intelligence of a horizon threat or maybe near-term threat that could impact U.S. critical infrastructure because of the tensions in Ukraine. My take on this is, especially when you look at the general, you know, tactics, techniques, procedures listed, this doesn't look like it's referring to any specific recent campaigns, attacks, intrusions. It's more talking about generally prepare for Russian adversaries who may come after U.S. critical infrastructure. And the kind of unstated thing is, due to the tensions in Ukraine. That's my take, at least.
That vibes, right? Like, I can see what you mean there, because when I read through it, it's like, be ready for the Russians. And by the way, here's their most common tradecraft, right? Their TTPs, here are the bugs they like to use. Joe, is that what you took away from this as well?
For the most part, yes. So like, I agree with Katie that when this came out, this was very much a strategic messaging versus live sort of activity. It is also interesting, though, in noting that most of the activity that's mentioned here is 2020 at the most recent or earlier. So this is very much a greatest hits compilation as opposed to the latest release of what the Sandworm team is recording in the studio right now. But it also ignores a couple of items, and I provided some feedback to people about this, so I'm not trying to call them out here, but things like ANSSI in France released a report on some exploitation activity linked to Russian actors involving some different software packages. So it's not complete either. So it's a really good overview of historical Russian linked, according to the U.S. government, activity, but it's also not complete. And we should, from a defender's perspective, be cautious in looking at this as being a state of the now as opposed to state of a year to almost 10 years ago, since Havix comes up in that document as well.
I guess that's interesting, right? That it's not the most current, and it seems to be more of a hand-wavy kind of get ready for the Russians vibe.
And that said, like, the guidance in there is good. Or yeah. Like, the chances that some Russian-based adversary is using PowerShell or exploiting some of these vulnerabilities somewhere in the world right now, yeah, that's probably happening,
yeah,
right?
Probably.
Even though, you know, this might not be the latest and greatest, like, chances are that these things are going to help prepare. So I'm sort of like, cool, you know, I'm not aware of anything specific, but there's probably something happening right now this guidance will help with.
Now, for this next item, probably the best way we can introduce it is to say, I lived through the Log4 shell drama and all I got was this crappy VMware bug. It seems like, and this turned into an interesting discussion in our Slack. If you think about the most impactful bugs we've seen over the last couple of years, something like Pulse Secure caused much more carnage. And my point was, well, now we're seeing the manifestations of the Log4j bug pop up in a similar way in mainstream IT products. And one of them is a VMware product called Horizons. And people are just using this like it's any other border device type of bug. We've seen it used in some lateral movement in ransomware campaigns, but apparently now it's starting to pop up as a sort of entry vector on a few things. We got two stories here discussing that. One of them looks at how it was used in an attack on the UK NHS, and another one says that there's a Chinese crew using it to deploy ransomware. So, Katie, why don't you start off by talking us through this one?
Yeah, this is interesting because I guess my overall impression is that I expected this to happen a little sooner to when the Log4j vulnerabilities were first announced. We all were kind of panicking when that happened, and we figured the pace of them being exploited in the wild would increase. And what I didn't factor in those first few days, and credit to a malware tech who kind of gave me this idea, is Log4j inherently is implemented in different ways in different applications. Yeah. And so I think that's part of the reason we didn't see such widespread exploitation in the same way initially. It was a lot of scanning, right? Some coin miners.
It's now funny. One thing is I was actually going to give last week's show the headline, Bad Guys Can't Java. But I didn't want to run with a gendered headline, basically. But yeah, Bad Guys Can't Java is really something that saved us here, right? And that's why we're seeing these these Log4j bugs in vendor solutions. They're the ones that are actually getting used because they are similar in function to these sort of Pulse Secure and Citrix and whatever bugs, right?
Exactly. And I think adversaries in VMware Horizon, which was previously known as Vue, and that's still in the file path, pro tip, I think adversaries have found an opportunity for software that's used really widely and that is internet facing a lot of the time. And so you're absolutely right. I think of this almost as sort of a subset of Log4j in like this is sort of a specific VMware Horizon vulnerability. But I'm concerned based on the fact that, right, we've seen it use Conti lateral movement. I think it was a Microsoft report on the dev Chinese affiliated group and the NHS report that came out. And so my sense is multiple adversaries are exploiting Horizon, which is where we start to get into slightly more scary territory, in my opinion, more impactful.
Sure. But I mean, the irritating thing here, as always, is that there is a functioning patch available for it. I mean, you know, like this, and that's what I mean. Like we had this big, scary new bug. And what's it resulted in? It's resulted in the same issues that we've been dealing with for years.
The basics aren't easy, Patrick.
That's true, yeah.
And in fairness, to jump in here, the patch route in question here is like, okay, so we're talking about targeting of a VMware product. So it's not as if an organization is patching Log4j, they're patching the VMware product, which for VMware Horizons is used for provisioning workstations and managing other systems. And so it's a high availability product. Now, granted, you could make the argument that we just went through the holiday period, so this is an ideal time for people to apply something that would result in potential service disruptions and some other items. But I think it harkens back to the Log4j issue, both from a defender as well as from an attacker perspective, that the way in which this works is very indirect in a number of instances, that you can throw a Log4j payload against an external facing web server, and that web server may be quite fine, but the entity that is logging traffic to that web server that's in your internal network that you're offloading logs to actually is vulnerable and then calls back. But then can it call back successfully, which is a question for the attacker. So there's a number of really confusing points for how the communication pathways, dependencies, and other items work that make this, you know, certainly an issue for defenders to try to ensure that they're getting coverage across the board, but also a non-trivial item for attackers to make sure that they understand where their payloads are popping up eventually, and what it is they can do with them once they arrive there. But from the vCenter and other item instances, my advice there is always get your stuff off the internet to the best extent possible.
But even if it's off the internet, we've seen Conti using it for lateral movement because it's such a great place to do lateral movement. I just think it's funny that this big framework bug that affected every single sort of enterprise Java application, no one could be bothered to do the Java shovel work to actually get shells. But, you know, they find it in a product and they just repurpose that, use it against multiple targets. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised. And we have seen some sort of upper tier adversaries attacking various governments with this and stuff like that, but that has kind of been hush hush a little bit. I think we'll find out more about that in the future. But yeah, it certainly wasn't a widespread thing. I think Adam and I talked about this last week. It's so easy to trigger it to get it to do something like a DNS lookup. But if you actually want to get fancy and use it for proper access, that's when it gets hard. Hey.
My thinking is, you know, we're probably going to see these clusters of different applications pop up over the next couple months, right? Adversaries are like, cool, Horizon, and then what's the next thing? There are so many options to choose from as adversaries kind of choose their, you know, prevalent internet-facing application.
I also do wonder, right, and I think this is one that we can't ignore, I wonder if like one ransomware crew or one APT crew or just one crew is currently sitting there with a bunch of Java textbooks, right? And on YouTube watching a bunch of tutorials and they're like, okay, I'm going to learn how to do this. And then they're just going to come out of nowhere and wreck everyone, right? I think that that is something that could happen.
It is something that could happen. And I'm hoping that they are also taking holidays so they don't want to read about Java.
We've also seen a similar type of bug turn up in something called the H2 database console, which I've never heard of, but it looks like it is actually used quite commonly out there. There's sort of 7,000 artifact dependencies. I think they call packages artifacts in the Java world. God knows why. But it's out there. It's being used by a lot of projects. I mean, is this something that we should be worried about, or is this only grabbing headlines because it's a similar style of bug?
That's kind of my take, is that right now the log4j train is really popular. And so everyone's kind of hitching to that. In looking at the original blog post, I was noting that they said, okay, it's critical, but the impact shouldn't be as widespread as the original log4j vulnerability. They acknowledged it themselves, which I think, yeah, it's sort of a headline grabber. But, you know, due to what they talk about in the specific configurations you have to have for this to matter and get a remote code execution, I don't think it's as wide of an impact. I think of this as like another of the vulnerabilities that happen every day.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't even be talking about it if they didn't, you know, invoke a log4j.
We've got a non-technical item here that I just want to mention. There's a link in this week's show notes, but Joe Sullivan, who is the former CISO of Uber, is now facing wire fraud charges in addition to the existing charges he was facing over the alleged cover-up of their 2016 data breach, where they did a retrospective quote-unquote bug bounty payment to the attacker who was essentially shaking them down. So yeah, feds are really throwing the book at Joe Sullivan, and you know, let that be a lesson to the rest of you, I think, is what we take away from that. But the next item I wanted to discuss with you two is all of the goings on at Signal. So it looks like Moxie Marlinspike is actually stepping down as CEO. Brian Acton, who's one of the co-founders of WhatsApp, is moving into the role, I think at least in an interim capacity for the time being. But they are really pushing ahead. Signal is really pushing ahead with its mobile coin push, right? So they're going into the sort of crypto payments, user-to-user crypto payments using a cryptocurrency called mobile coin, which isn't universally available across exchanges right now, but I expect that will change. Alex Stamos wrote a big thread about this, saying they don't realize the legal attack surface that they're opening here and the trouble they're about to have. Joe, let's start with you. What do you think about this?
So I think that Alex is right, that as you start getting into the payments processing and transaction landscape, that you start opening up yourself to a number of know your customer and who those customers are and what they're using it for sort of avenues, which, you know, Signal is a very important tool. I'm sure yourself, myself, Katie, many others that are listening right now,
OPSEC, use that as a OPSEC.
Anyway, as a communication tool, among others. And then to start getting into the financial aspects really does raise a different set of risk profile. I can't comment specifically on what that profile might be, but just in terms of legal encumbrances, it seems like it's a completely different animal than what they're used to.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things jumped out to me in reading through all of this this week. First of all, there's only like 30 people at Signal, which is just amazing when you think about what they've achieved, right? That they essentially operate this vital piece of communications infrastructure and it's 30 people. That's just extraordinary. In Andy Greenberg's write-up, though, one thing that really jumped out was, you know, Matt Green, right? Matthew Green, the cryptographer, who's usually right on rah-rah freedom. And he's quoted in this going, I don't know, man, right? And when you've got that sort of, when you got people like Matt Green saying, gee, I don't know, this might be a bit radical, that makes you think that they might run into some problems here. And it is the case that they're using one of these privacy-focused coins. There's no discussion of what guardrails they might have on this, if they might limit payment frequency or put an upper limit on transaction amounts, things like that. But this is going to propel privacy coins into mainstream usage. Katie, what are your feelings on this?
We haven't said the R word. Really? You haven't mentioned ransomware yet? Of course, that's the first thing I think of this with this switch is, oh man, I can't wait for ransomware actors to be like, you can just pay me on Signal. Easy.
But it's not even, just adding to what you're saying there, it's not even, oh, you can pay me on Signal. It's that you're basically rolling out a platform to millions of people to exchange a privacy-related, a privacy coin called Mobile Coin. You know, you don't need to use Signal to transact in that thing, but essentially what they're going to do is conjure a privacy coin into existence that's going to be used and will have value assigned to it and will be able to be used as a payments, as an on-chain payment instrument that's completely nothing to do with the Signal app. So yeah, that's interesting that, because currently there's what, Monero, there's Zcash or whatever it's called, but this one, it'll be a clear winner if they pull this off.
Yeah, and the other thing that I don't know makes me a little sad about this is, I don't know if you all agree, but I feel like I have a really positive image of Signal, and a lot of people in the security community, I would argue even like law enforcement, even though they hate they can't get the contents, like a lot of law enforcement uses this, but I feel like this maybe in terms of brand harm. Right? Like, yeah, I'm kind of like, really, Signal? Is this the thing you did? Like, I love your app and like, thank you for the 30 developers for what you've done. But I'm not sure this is going to be a great PR move. I don't know if they care about that. It makes sense on the privacy vein, but I don't know. Is Signal going to be as loved as they once were?
Yeah, it's hard, right? And I just wonder what problem they're trying to solve here too. Ah, now, one of my favorite items this week, this is a Catalan Kimpanu article from The Record. The United States has charged an Italian gentleman who was behind a 5-year phishing scheme in which he posed as publishers and literary agents and whatnot so he could illicitly obtain manuscripts, book manuscripts. And the thing that I love most about this was his motive, which is he just wanted to get the writing so that he could try to bite their style, basically, which is just so hilarious and such a 2021 story. I wish we could talk about stuff like this every week. Joe, what did you make of this?
So it's a really fascinating story. And on a personal level, a researcher I work with, Chad Anderson, had done some research into this previously and identified a number of domains that had been linked to this campaign and that got reported about a few months ago in the lead up to the indictment. So this has been going on for a little bit.
I mean, that's something I didn't mention. This thing has been going on for years. Like, people in the publishing world knew about this guy who was out there, and they thought there were all these suspicious commercial motives and whatnot. No, it's just someone who wanted to read the book.
Just some dude who is out there for personal gain and not even that, you know, like, interesting of a game when you really come down to it. And it's fascinating that you would put that amount of effort into this sort of activity, but it was pretty good effort though at the same time. So maybe don't question what someone's motives might be as long as they have sufficient technical capability to back it up. But it's a really fascinating sort of, maybe not quite talented Mr. Ripley style or whatever, crime caper or whatever, but
I mean, I'm impressed too, because didn't this guy have something like 160 domains? Katie, like, this is a one-man, you know, this is a one-man APT crew, basically, at this point. Even though they're using dumb tradecraft, they definitely got the operationally sophisticated part right. I'm impressed.
Depends how you define APT, right? The domain piece jumped out at me as well. Of course, like, as a security person, I'm always like, oh, they registered more than 160 domain names that were similar to publishers and talent agencies. And of course, I immediately think, well, that's typo squatting, and right, defenders could have caught these if the publishing house was looking for typo squatted domains that were similar to their real name. And then I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, they probably don't have big security teams to do that. But it's kind of interesting because you see these things all the time, right? Brand reputation hey, what's similar? And people are like, oh, who could be preparing for a phishing campaign? Or it could just be this dude.
That's why I like it, is because he's taken the it's not dumb if it works approach of low tier APT crews and just done it as a private citizen. And
well, I mean, in fairness, advanced persistent threat.
Yeah.
You know, relatively advanced. He was very persistent. And I suppose it was a threat to these organizations.
Well,
so,
we always say the thing that makes an APT an APT isn't technical sophistication, it's operational sophistication. You could be using absolutely trash TTPs, but as long as you're organized, you'll win, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Interesting one here. We see so many lawsuits these days that are related to, you know, hacking. Like even Microsoft suing APT crews to take their domains and things just so they can get the right court paperwork and legal mechanisms. Activision is suing Call of Duty cheat sellers. Joe Cox has the story for Vice. I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this one is if you want to talk about people who know how to hack, right, the cheat, anti-cheat world, some of the most brilliant computing minds I've ever met work in that area. Now we're seeing the lawsuits come out. And I think I say, as someone who does play games, I'm a console peasant, right? But unfortunately, with Battlefield 2042, they put you in the same server as PC players. So now I have to deal with cheaters. So I say, yes, let's start with the lawsuits and move to the executions. What did you two make of this?
Yeah, for me, of course, I'm always going to come back to threat modeling. And I have a couple of friends who work for gaming companies. And it's so interesting. As you note, the people who work in anti-cheat are so smart.
Yeah.
And in thinking about, right, the greatest threats to each organization and like what threats should they protect against, like cheaters are core to the business model of these gaming companies. And so, you know, I feel like I'm not shocked that this happened because it's an inherent threat to their core business model. Like people aren't going to play if they're a bunch of cheaters.
But I just wonder how they're going to win it long term, right? Like I understand that with consoles, there's some protection there, right? There actually is. But when you're dealing with PC games, it's very hard to get anti-cheat happening that can't be bypassed. It is very hard.
Well, it's very hard, but it also makes it increasingly inconvenient. And I think that gets to the point where it's a double-edged sword. I've done that much gaming in the last few years, but I've done enough to understand that when you start getting into whether it's the DRM requirements or the anti-cheat plugins that are required, that you start getting into very fundamental aspects of the operating system that these programs are plugging into in order to either evade or to target this sort of capability, which is why these are really smart people. Like malware developers should be hiring cheat and anti-cheat developers.
That was
like,
actually something. That was something I was going to say, which is if some of these cheat, anti-cheat people actually applied their knowledge to malware, I mean, we would see some pretty cool stuff start popping up, right?
Yeah, it'd be really, really scary. Having said that, like on the one hand, the environment is so big, but also the risks with esports and with robust online communities are so prevalent that I think you're just getting into maybe even a potentially accelerated version of the same sort of offense defense playoff that we see in general computer security within the competitive gaming space as a result. How it ends up, I don't know, but neither side can really say that they give up because the incentive to continue are just so powerful.
Yeah, I mean, where it gets interesting for me is where people are doing stuff like using cameras pointed at their screen and then emulating a mouse and a keyboard, right, to actually do the playing inputs. And how do you detect that, right? Like at that point, you're not detecting the cheat software, you're actually detecting cheat behavior. So it's a fascinating field. So I just wanted to touch on it. But I hope these lawsuits do de-incentivize some of the bigger cheat providers because they are ruining it for the rest of us.
So, careful what you wish for. They'll become ransomware developers then.
That doesn't affect
me.
They'll
find new jobs.
Fine, you know? That's a good point. So another Catalan one here, and I love this because it's just so old school. Well, kind of. Fin7 is mailing US companies bad USB devices. Now, Fin7 was one of these, you know, financial crime actors that has done a pretty hard pivot to ransomware in recent times. But they're sending USB devices to people that they might look like a gift from Amazon, or they might look like COVID-19 guidance from the government or whatever. So this box turns up, you plug the USB in, and then it does a bad USB attack where it emulates sort of mouse and keyboard and goes and runs a bunch of PowerShell and then ransomwares your whole organization. I just think it's crazy that we've still got attackers out there you know, dropping USBs. I mean, I know that it's not like auto-executing malware anymore, that it's a different approach. But the fact that we've still got people dropping little USB devices, maybe not in parking lots in this case, but just sending them out by mail and hoping to snare targets that way. It's just, you know, it's just proof that they're gonna try anything that works. What did you think of this, Katie?
Yeah, this is fascinating because they also did this a year or so ago. And I think this is an update to that report. And I think maybe the adversaries are taking advantage of this community's tendency to run towards shiny objects and forget about old things, right? USB, I don't know who's like thought about your USB malware detection lately, or like, what do you detect that's spawning from USB?
But it's not even, it's not even a file system that, you know, like this is actually a, you know, keyboard emulator or whatever, right? So it's not like your malware detection's going to do much good. And I was actually going to ask you, because you are, you know, a senior staffer at Red Canary and you're a detection and response kind of company. How would you, you know, what's your best bet at picking up something like this?
It's tough. And right, as I was saying, a lot of orgs aren't looking at this, right? They're not looking at the USB initial attack vector. A lot of times this looks exactly like legit behavior. And so really tough, like I would say, honestly, the best bet might be after that initial insertion, what do they do after that? It's a very dissatisfying answer,
yeah.
But right, that initial insertion is not going
to
look.
That's what I thought you'd say. It's going to come down to either you're using allow listing or your EDR spots it because it's funny PowerShell.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of ways of approaching this too. There's certainly the defense in depth approach that it's like, okay, bad USB gets plugged in, emulates a keyboard system, runs a bunch of commands. Like, okay, that's cool. Let me go see what your call out is or your attempt to communicate back to the controller is to take advantage of this. You know, you could also go routes in terms of like, oh, if I'm an EDR product and I already have a registered keyboard that's active within the system, and I see another device that's attempting to emulate a keyboard system that's trying to plug in at the same time, like, oh, that's kind of weird. Maybe I block that, or maybe I alert on that. I don't know, because every time I make an assumption about what an EDR or a host-based detection product should do, some vendor tells me that I don't know what I'm talking about and there are exceptions and they catch this anyway. But these things still happen, so I don't know.
If it was universally caught by every single endpoint security product, they probably wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah. Right.
The challenge is, we always say, we're like, this should never happen legitimately on an endpoint. And as soon as you say that, you find someone who uses something in a way you didn't expect.
Yeah, because Frank likes to use two keyboards, one for his left hand, one for his right hand, you know?
Of course.
But you know what I mean, right? Like there's always a funny one out there doing something weird, yeah. Now it's time to talk about a hacker party trick. Another one from Gatlin here. So the headline is, threat actors can simulate iPhone reboots and keep iOS malware on a device. This is just research that someone thought up and then published, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Now, high-grade iOS implants, sorry to burst everyone's bubble, but they do survive reboots, right? So there's been this whole meme running through the security community for the last few years that if you don't want an implant to persist on an iOS device, you reboot it and it goes away. Okay, now that might work for some stuff, right? But the high-grade stuff does survive reboots. Now, that said, if you could load up code like this where it just simulates a reboot, where you'd go to turn off your phone and it just blacks the screen and acts like it's switched off, that opens up options as an exploit developer to use some of your lower grade stuff for persistence. So I actually found this one pretty interesting. What did you make of it?
I think it's definitely interesting research, but of course, as a threat person, I'm always looking for, okay, when and if the adversaries will be applying this theoretical thing. And I wouldn't want people to take away the concept that, oh, you should never reboot your iPhone because it's not going to stop everything. Like that's still going to catch low-level stuff and stop that from persisting. So yeah, I mean, I'm just watching to see, is this going to be adopted by proper villains, as my teammates says.
But I mean, my point is, it's not the proper villains who need this, right? So you're saying, okay, you can turn it off and clear the low-grade stuff. I mean, if I'm out there pushing the low-grade stuff, I'm going to do this so that my stuff doesn't get cleared. Right? Like, I just think it's just...
Well, it's not even the low-grade people necessarily. It could be the high-grade people not trying to burn high-grade tools that are trying to...
Yeah, this is kind of what I was getting at in the intro, which is like, oh, okay, now you can use your crappier non-persistent code, right? Because you've got this way of preventing people from clearing it with a reboot. I mean, that's not to say you shouldn't reboot your... As Katie said, it's not to say you shouldn't reboot your iOS device, but I don't know, man. I just think this is actually a lot more useful than it looks at first glance.
I agree. It's useful. It certainly lowers the bar for certain types of attack thresholds, and it adds a tool to the toolbox, even for high-end actors, that instead of burning either complex tools or tools that have to take a much more in-depth interaction with the iOS platform to enable capabilities. And so it is non-trivial. Having said that, I completely agree with Katie. Reboot your stuff often. You know, it's good security hygiene, so to speak. But it's not something that we can just laugh off that this is a, you know, given the amount of iOS exploits that we've seen and how they function, it's not something that can just be shrugged off as like, oh, this is a party trick, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, even the trash iOS exploits that might not survive reboot, they're still being put together by, you know, professional developers, right? So that's why I think we're going to see this actually being used. But anyway, moving on to the next thing. Now, last year we did see a bug like this one that we're about to discuss affecting one of those like remote desktop services. I think it was Microsoft. So I can't even remember which one it was, but it was one of the major cloud providers, Office remote desktops. And there was a flaw in the USB over network drivers, right? Which was actually pretty bad. We've seen a similar bug now that's affecting like Soho routers, right? But I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this, even though on its own it's not really a big deal, is these USB over network drivers look pretty bad and they're everywhere.
I mean, Soho routers in general are pretty bad and everywhere, especially in a work from home environment. And I think it just highlights the general issue with that entire product category. It's been amazing to me that there hasn't been more of an effort to try to at least somewhat improve how this sort of thing works, as so many people in vital positions are working from a home office or whatever as a result of COVID or just evolutions in the workplace environment. And we're still relying on these crappy devices that use crappy drivers in order to do fundamental sort of security tasks that are easily subverted or taken advantage of by threat actors. I
mean, but what do you think about these the issue of you know, USB over network driver vulnerabilities and like where else that could pop up in the supply chain?
I mean, honestly, it depends. So in looking at things like USB over cloud, USB over remote connectivity or whatever, it's very much vendor specific and in terms of what you're allowing and what you're enabling from a security posture. And I know organizations have turned this off for this very reason, that they don't want that sort of data transfer. They just want keyboard and mouse and, you know, eliminate this, which maybe this highlights that organizations need to take a clearer or a more robust approach to like, hey, when I'm turning on these sorts of capabilities, what sort of data transfer, what sort of input output streams am I allowing? And do I understand all the items that are actually enabled by the platform that I'm using? Because I'm pretty sure most people don't actually understand all the possibilities that are enabled in a lot of modern platforms, which are pretty robust and pretty varied at this point in time.
Katie, I wanted to get your thoughts on this one. We've seen a port of some ransomware called S-File, which has apparently gone through a name change. It's now called S-Cal. That's been ported now over to Linux-based systems. How much Linux-based ransomware do we actually see, right? It doesn't seem to come up all that often in the news. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I agree with you that we don't hear about Linux ransomware actually on systems and affecting enterprises a lot. And that makes me very worried.
Yeah,
it seems like
fertile, untouched ground, right?
Yeah, my suspicion is, right, they're probably not going after end users like Joe who use Linux on the desktop. But what I'm worried about is all the organizations who use Linux in their cloud infrastructure. And are they really monitoring that? I assume they would know that if it was ransomed, they'd probably figure that out. But I worry a little bit that we don't hear anything about it. We hear occasionally about Linux ransomware is in development, right? Porting from Windows to Linux. But I think it's a space worth watching. But I also think that Linux obviously is inherently different than Windows. And adversaries haven't yet, I think, seen the return on investment in targeting Linux systems. Maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same reaction as you, which is we've seen lots of stories about, oh, a new ransomware strain popped up that, you know, hosed one box and one Linux box. And it just never has really turned into a thing. But now that ransomware is well into its, is a well-established crime type, I just do wonder if that's going to change. Joe, what do you think of this?
Yeah, and I think you started to hint at what the issue is here, is that it's a question of scalability and degree of impact that, for Windows environments, like, oh, I get Active Directory, I can push a script out that will encrypt an entire ecosystem in minutes, maybe hours, you know, depending upon what's going on, that results in the sort of big game hit that most ransomware groups are after. Whereas from a Linux perspective, I don't necessarily have that central management, central administrative portal that I could use to encrypt an entire fleet of Linux devices. And so, you know, maybe it's more worthwhile and financially helpful to install a crypto miner on a one by one basis based upon some exploit or whatnot than it is to try to individually deploy ransomware on these devices. Having said that, as we get more organizations deploying into cloud-centric environments with centralized management and other sorts of infrastructures, that does open up the possibility if adversaries could subvert those sorts of management infrastructures in order to deploy ransomware on a widespread basis. Thankfully, we have not seen that yet, and so ransomware in Linux remains a sort of onesie-twosie proposition, but I will not doubt ransomware developers and their tenacity to get there at some point in the future.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, staying with ransomware, and we've seen, you know, your usual smattering of attacks hit the headlines over the last week. One was a company called Finalsight, which apparently, you know, makes a website platform that's used by 8,000 schools, and they do things like send out communications to parents with it and whatever. And it looks like ultimately it wasn't really a successful attack because they're restoring from backups, but, you know, just another example of these crews going after, you know, impacting schools. I just think it's so shitty, basically. We also saw county government in Albuquerque get ransomware, right? So another local government attack. That's nothing really we need to discuss here.
My neighborhood.
Oh, of course it is too. Did you feel any impact on this one?
Did not. So I don't live there, but it's close. But it just goes to highlight that the local and regional government perspective isn't going away, despite claims to avoid critical infrastructure and other things by the part of these operators.
Well, one thing that we're really interested to see how it plays out, as we spoke about this last week, is bond investors are starting to get spooked. You know, municipal bonds, bond raisers, if they start to fail, then all of a sudden there's going to be a lot of job openings spring up at local governments and councils. Now, Catalan has this story here. Now, this is the ransomware story that I found interesting this year, is a hotel chain, Nordic Choice Hotels. They operate 200 hotels across Northern Europe. They got ransomware, and as part of their response, they just got Chrome OS and migrated using CloudReady, and it worked. And I'm just like, if we see more of this, this might actually send a shudder through some spines at Redmond. What did you think of this, Katie?
Yeah, I mean, I think this dovetails nicely from our Linux discussion, right? Any enterprise that goes to a non-Windows-based operating system and enterprise focus is less likely to get targeted by ransomware. Like, that's the reality. And so I think it's kind of a genius move. This is the first I've heard of an enterprise doing this, but especially for orgs who don't have the needs for a whole lot of computing power.
Yeah, and they're reusing their old computers because Chrome OS isn't as hungry. I don't even think it's a matter of just being obscure and not being Windows. It's also that Chrome OS is just a simpler OS and has some pretty decent security features into it. The thing that spun me out about this one is that they were actually able to do such a significant migration. I think it was 2,000 systems. They were able to do that in the midst of a ransomware attack and do it quite easily. Was that your takeaway too, Joe? That was like, holy God, you can do this stuff now.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because from a security community perspective, I remember being at a conference like 7 years ago or whatever, and someone stood up in response to a question about attacks like, "Oh, just switch all your operating systems to Chrome OS." That person got laughed at. But at the same time, like, that probably would have worked pretty well to avoid a number of intrusions.
Yeah, guess who's been sleeping well the last 3 years, right?
Right.
That guy.
Yeah. Having said that, though, I also wonder that as maybe more organizations pivot away from a Windows ecosystem into other avenues, just as we've seen things like insecure S3 buckets and other sort of avenues for adversaries to get access to things of value and hold them, maybe not for ransom in the encryption standpoint, but to either leak things, get access to things, and selectively release them. Has this migration to Chrome OS, what sort of chinks in the armor exist? Having said that, there might not be that much incentive for others to probe into that just right now because the battlefield is so fertile in terms of other targets to pick from at the moment. But as more organizations take that sort of perspective, I'm curious what security issues will emerge as a result of that over time.
I mean, there's been a bit of a Twitter InfoSec argument over the last few days about, I think someone tweeted, oh, security, stop saying security through obscurity gets you nothing, right? It does. Yeah. And it's a big lie. And, you know, this is just a perfect example of that, right? Which is, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the person next to you. This is more like, I don't know, just cover yourself in something that bears don't generally eat or something. I don't know. I'm stretching for metaphors here, but I think you would be sleeping pretty well, like if you were using Chrome OS right now.
Yeah, Windows is like honey to bears. There we go.
There we go.
For salmon.
Just cover the other guy in honey. There you go. We're going to close it out now with a recommendation for a long read. And it's very fitting as he's stepping down that we're actually talking about a blog post written by Moxie Marlinspike. And it's titled My First Impressions of Web3. And it is just a terrific read. It's about the whole NFT ecosystem, what a lot of the people piling into it don't seem to understand about the platforms that enable most of the interaction with these blockchains and stuff. It's just a really, really good read. And it's quite funny as well. Did you two both read this?
I have.
Katie's shaking her head, which means she didn't do it.
It's on my list. I've read the tweets about it. And the message for myself is that maybe I should stop being a jerk and dismissing NFTs and actually read and listen to what he has to say.
Oh, but I mean, what he has to say, it's not exactly flattering to NFTs, but Joe, which is what makes it so great too, because this is someone who is clearly a believer in cryptocurrencies. He's about to, he's left Signal at a point where it's about to make cryptocurrencies more widely used than at any other point in history. But he takes a big old dump on NFTs, including actually selling one that changes based on how you access it. And if you access it the most common way, it actually is just a giant poop emoji. But Joe, you read through this. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway is always questioning what your sort of utopian dreams might be in the tech ecosystem. And I think, especially given who is reporting here or who is writing here, that this is something that a lot of people that are proponents of the industry really need to pay attention to, because this started off as a really good faith, in my opinion, as someone that did not have good faith opinions of the topic of NFTs and et cetera, of like, oh, let's actually take this at face value for a minute, and then showing how decentralization, how concepts of ownership and other sorts of ideals around this item really just sort of fall apart over time. So,
he points out that like all of this NFT activity is being handled basically by two APIs, and that if you are selling something that they don't like, they'll just filter it at the API level, right? Even though it's on the blockchain, it's kind of shadow banned and whatever. So it's just, and as you say, he does go into it saying, well, I'm going to look into this thing and have a look at it. And then he just sort of rips it to shreds, which is funny because he's a crypto utopian, right? Who's like, no, this is really ridiculous, this stuff. Yep. It's just such a great read.
Added to my list.
Agreed. You should add it, Katie. And yes, it's a very fine overview and argument against those concepts.
Yeah. Or it just makes a good case that they've been huffing their own farts and don't necessarily understand that the whole thing is as centralized as everything else. But that's actually it for our weekly news discussion. Joe Slowick, Katie Nichols, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That was Katie Nichols and Joe Slowick there with a chat about the week's security news. Big thanks to them for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Mark Rogers, the Executive Director of Cybersecurity at Okta. He is working with the Institute for Security and Technology, or IST, on a paper about the Log4j fiasco. And he joined me to share his thoughts on the broader event. As you'll hear, he thinks bugs like this show us that we need to think a bit more carefully about how we mitigate stuff when quick and easy patching isn't an option. Here's Mark Rogers.
We've been increasingly seeing that vulnerability management on the internet has become like a spectator sport, kind of choose your own adventure. Everyone wants to participate. So the moment a sniff of some kind of vulnerability comes out, people start cyber sleuthing. They try to work out where the vulnerability is in the code. They try to work out whether there's a POC. And if not, they start a race to build a POC. And what you end up with is like thousands of minds working together on crafting what that vulnerability could look like. And so you end up with a massively accelerated exploit maturity curve. Back in the old days, you would get a vulnerability drop, and then you would see kind of a slow progression towards development of POCs. You know, maybe there was a POC pushed out with the original disclosure, but often that was kept secret. It wasn't shared.
Or it was shared broken, right? Which is something a lot of people used to do. Yeah.
Or it was shared broken or, you know, crippled in some way. And it would take a while before an actual viable exploit that didn't just pop calc would start to circulate. And that would, and then there would still be an even further evolution before that became an actual weaponized, reliable attack that people could use. Take a look now at, say, Log4j, and what you have is all of that compressed into a matter of hours. As soon as
Don't you think, though, that to a degree is because it was an inherently, you know, throw string at thing and load your own class is not exactly something that's tremendously difficult to figure out.
That's definitely part of it. But if you go back through the vulnerabilities that have been internet sleuthed and look at how fast they're all exposed, I think you'd be hard to find one that hasn't been crafted into a weaponized exploit in under 48 hours.
Yeah, I think you're right when it comes to like enterprise grade software stuff. That's absolutely right. I think it's a little bit of a different picture when you're talking about, you know, exploits that might be affecting, you know, Chrome or Win 10 guts or, yep, you know, iOS or things like that. But when it comes to anything sort of, yeah, Java or some VPN gateway device or whatever, yeah, it's the turnaround is quick. You'll see an advisory that just might have a little bit of info in it and then, yeah, the race is on. Accepted. Yep. Yes,
and I agree. And I think that in turn colors the way that businesses have to respond to these kinds of vulnerabilities. It's really hard to predict in those early days, also those early minutes even, whether or not a vulnerability is going to be one that's going to push out. Sure, there may be some information in terms of things like you're not vulnerable if blah, 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 that you can use to put together to work out, and this probably means this, this, this. But the reality is you've got to hit it like a starter pistol. And that's a complete change to the way that we've done vulnerability management across any organization historically. You know, back 10 years ago, vulnerability management was like mostly in the realms of compliance. You'd run a thing inside your network and it would make a report and you'd order everything in terms of the CVSS score that it came out with, high, medium, low, and prioritize your resources based on that. You can't afford to do that anymore because by the time you've even gotten that report, the chances are exploitation is already well underway. And in the case of Log4j, like the different exploitation pathways that appeared just within 12 hours was absolutely incredible. Like I was watching companies defend themselves with WAF rules and hide behind these WAF rules. And within minutes of those WAF rules coming out, there was a new obfuscated payload.
Oh man, that was ridiculous. It got to a point where I think someone said it best. I can't remember who it was, but it was someone who very much knows what they're talking about, said there is no regular expression you can write for this thing that's going to work in a WAF. Like, forget it.
Right. And this is something that we're going to have to accept is that, you know, okay, WAFs have some usage in terms of filtering out common things, filtering out some of the noise. But when it comes to this kind of stuff, you're better off focusing on securing all of your infrastructure and actually finding out where the weaknesses are than hiding behind the WAF.
Well, I think one thing that I mentioned on last week's show in the news segment is that when I think it was Caesar put out some advice saying, you know, roll WAF rules and stuff. And the thing that they didn't mention was egress filtering, which was really weird because, and as Adam pointed out, like the sort of people who have a lot of Java are the sort of people who have a lot of checkpoint. Right. So maybe that's one of the reasons we didn't see quite as much carnage as we were expecting is because there was decent egress filtering in place in a lot of these places. But yeah, I think that would have saved the day, right? Some just basic, good, well-done network controls, old school, would have got you a long way here.
I think that's true. But I think the reason there wasn't quite as much carnage is because it was an unusual exploit in that it was really simple in terms of understanding how it worked, but actually really hard to predict where it was going to work and the terms it was going to work under. Like it's because it's not something that is exposed like a service. You can't go and pre-map an environment and say, these are the points that I'm going to hit on this network. And this is how I'm going to get in. And this is my strategy for lateral movement and stuff. You're popping shells inside logging infrastructure.
Yeah, five days later, after some batch process runs, right?
Right, yeah. You don't have control over the timing. You don't have control over the architecture. And so in many cases, like because it was the asynchronicity of like sending in the payload and then the shell popping 3 days later, I think quite a lot of people miss the shells that they spawned inside things. I think there's going to be shells popping for the next month.
Yeah.
They're just going to appear. And that made it actually quite a difficult vulnerability for someone to just straight out take and leverage as a vector to get into something.
I think to me, the stuff that was most alarming, right, the stuff that made me really go, oh, was when you realized that a lot of equipment from companies like, you know, Cisco used it. Right. And that's when you're not having to worry about customizing your attack. That's when you're just like, okay, I've got it working on this one Cisco box. Now I can go attack all of their customers. And that, you know, that was a pretty hair-raising exposure window, I think.
100%.
And you know, they would have done what everyone else did. They would have gone through their source, you know, found it, patched it, shipped it out. But you're still talking about a vulnerability, you know, exposure window there, like a week. You know, a week is a long time to have a trivially exploitable bug in your Cisco's, for example. So that was the stuff that I thought, well, here's the risk. And thankfully, it doesn't look like it really happened. But yeah, geez, woof.
There's a couple of things to unpack there. One, I totally agree. And some of the more serious exploitation that I'm hearing on the grapevine is from products like VMware that are being targeted. And I think as soon as bad guys had a product they understood, as just became another vector into that product, then it was game on. And I think you're going to see much more serious exploitation in the long tail because of exactly
instead of
that
people
kind
trying
of
to figure out how to load their exploit classes into people's horrible Java apps, right, that they wrote themselves. Yeah, no, I think we agree there. So what was it like from the Okta side, though, when this thing landed? I mean, I imagine you would have had a lot of customers at you saying, what's your exposure like and what do we do and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I imagine there were a lot of people running around over what should have been a restful and joyful time, Mark, but what did the response at Okta look like?
I would sum it up by saying all hands on deck. I would call this kind of vulnerability, and I think we're going to see a lot more like it, whole department vulnerabilities, because there was literally no part of the Okta security department that wasn't involved in this in some form. The threat intelligence teams were looking forward at the evolution of it, because you had things like when it started using DNS as a covert channel, so that you could hijack secrets out of things like AWS stores.
That was actually pretty cool, right? When you could start exfilling AWS keys in DNS queries. Uh-huh. That was nice. Nice. We like it.
Right? Yeah. Right? But at the same time, oh dear.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's all fun when you're the spectator in the gladiator-like event. It's not so much fun when you're the one, you know, surrounded by lions.
So you've got the threat intelligence teams like ferociously looking at this and tracking something that's evolving as quick as lightning. And you've got the application security teams and offensive security teams who are essentially hands-on with products and components and evaluating. Because, you know, you can't simply assume. In many cases, the information that was coming out of some of the suppliers was incomplete. And so you had to go dive, make sure that was this component in. If there was an assumption that this component is safe, we had to validate that it was safe. And so that meant step by step going through anything that we think had any kind of exposure, testing it and ensuring that it didn't have any kind of exposure.
Does Okta use much Java in its, you know, core product?
It's kind of hard to quantify. Okta uses Java. It's there in a few pieces. I mean, I think you
The reason I asked that is ultimately now that we're sort of, this is mostly in the rearview mirror, what was your exposure actually like?
I wouldn't say it was catastrophic, but we did have things like external agents that had risk. If you take a look at the bulletin we put out, you can see the list of things that we considered may have exposure and the list of things that we identified. And I think it was only two things that actually had significant exposure and it was remedied quickly, but you know, it only takes one thing to cause a real problem. And so that was the hardest part for us. It was
just finding out what to fix.
The absolute diligence you had to do to verify everything. And we didn't want to make any kind of statement until we had our hands on all of the information.
And so hang on, we're kind of running out of time here, Mark. So I just wanted to ask you, you know, earlier you were talking about how this has turned into a spectator blood sport, right, on the internet as everyone races to weaponize stuff and get it out there as quickly as possible. You alluded to something earlier, and I just wanted to pick up on that a bit, which is that, you know, oftentimes surviving these experiences is going to come down to, you know, just making sure you have your ducks in a row, basically, right? Make sure that your compensating controls can mitigate the worst of it. I guess that's where you're coming from, right?
Well, yes. I mean, we found that out. That was one of the sort of the big lessons that came out of SolarWinds, is it's all about blast control. You know, if these things are going to happen, you have to have adequate blast control in place to ensure you've thought about all the worst case scenarios to deal with it. But I would say the other thing that comes out of this is that intelligence is now critical to vulnerability management. You can't just rely on things like CVSS scores to guide you in terms of what resources you should put out. Look at some of the later Log4j.
When you say intelligence, I think what you really mean is it's important to understand a threat and how it might affect your environment, which is a little bit different to what people normally mean when they say intelligence.
I don't know. Maybe it's all of the above. but yes, it's understanding your environment. It's understanding how things impact your environment. Contextual assessment of impact is really important. You can't take a bland score and then assume that that's going to give you a really good idea of what the risk is to you. But there's also the external intelligence piece, which is you have to understand what the dynamic is going on with this vulnerability. What's the pace it's moving at? What are the different attack pathways that have evolved in it? Like we saw in this one, there are at least three different attack pathways that came out of it. And some of them were specifically designed to bypass the very defensive measures that were being implemented in real time. If you're not monitoring for that, there's a very real risk that you'll put in place compensating controls that are already deprecated.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Mark Rogers, thank you so much for joining us to share your thoughts with us on, I guess, the wider context around the Log4j bug. And oh, goody, we get to see more of these in coming years. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. Cheers.
Always a pleasure.
That was Mark Rogers from Okta there in this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Okta for being a Risky Business sponsor. You can find them at okta.com. And that is it for this week's show. I'll be dropping a Soapbox edition in a couple of days featuring Steve Miller from Stairwell. That one's all about how threat intelligence is something you should do, not something you should consume. And it's pretty cool stuff. But yeah, until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.